Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. U.S. officials say hackers in China launched a massive cyber attack on the federal agency responsible for collecting background information on and issuing security clearances for millions of government employees. The Office of Personnel Management said Thursday as many as 4 million current and former federal employees may have been affected in what is the most extensive breach of government personnel data in years. As the Human Resources Office of the U.S. federal government, OPM is seen as a high-value hacking target. Reports of additional Russian military moves in eastern Ukraine are prompting new concern in the West. The United Nations Security Council has convened an emergency meeting for Friday morning to discuss the developments. While U.S. defense officials and diplomats meet behind closed doors in Germany, Moscow denies providing military support to pro-Russian separatists, which are located in eastern Ukraine. But NATO says it has precise information that this is the case. Zlatiza Hoch reports.
Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko warned Thursday of the colossal threat of a large-scale offensive by Russian-backed rebels.
There are 14 Russian battalions, tactical groups that include over 9,000 Russian military servicemen in Ukrainian territory. The concentration of Russian servicemen along the national border with Ukraine is 1.5 times bigger than a year ago.
Russia adamantly denies such reports. Zlatiza Hoch, VOA News, Washington.
You are listening to The Voice of America, coming to you from Washington, D.C. U.S. military officials say coalition airstrikes are having a profound effect on Islamic State militants in Iraq and that the coalition is taking the enemy off the battlefield in significant numbers. Lieutenant General John Hesterman, chief of the air campaign, said Friday that he doesn't believe IS is making major advances around the country. His comments come days after U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Antony Blinken said the military operation against IS killed more than 10,000 militant fighters in less than a year. Authorities in Pakistan revealed Friday that an anti-terrorism court, citing lack of evidence, has acquitted most of the suspects charged with planning the October 2012 assassination attempt on Nobel Prize winner Malala Yousafzai. The revelation came almost a month after police in the Swat district had announced that all 10 men who stood trial in connection with the crime were convicted and sentenced to 25-year jail terms. 17-year-old Malala Yousafzai was critically wounded in the attack and was later flown to Britain for treatment, where she now resides. This week, the Philippines president was in Japan, where he spoke to friendly audiences about China's expansive maritime territorial claims. Tensions over territorial disputes with China are building in both Tokyo and Manila, but that is doing little to slow Beijing's efforts to build artificial islands in the South China Sea. From Manila, Simone Orondine reports.
In the Philippines, there is broad support for opposing China, but some, like New Alliance Party Secretary General Renato Reyes, say Manila should do so largely without relying on U.S. help.
The Filipino people will not allow incursions into our territorial waters, incursions into our exclusive economic zone. We will not allow the driving away of our fishermen, and we oppose the aggressive reclamation that is being done.
Getting outside support in the sea dispute was high on Philippine President Benigno Aquino's agenda during a state visit to Japan this week. After their meeting, Prime Minister Shinzo Abe and Mr. Aquino put out a joint statement expressing serious concern over the reclamation work. Simone Orendine for VOA News, Manila.
Officials in Nigeria say more than 30 people have been killed in a bomb blast in Yola, the capital of Adamawa State in Nigeria's northeast, where the militant group Boko Haram is active. Rescuers in central China have raised a cruise ship that capsized on the Yangtze River and say there's no chance of finding anyone else alive as the death toll reached at least 97. And the U.S. economy gained 280,000 jobs in May, while the unemployment rate rose slightly to 5.5% as more people began searching for jobs. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Hayes Wuhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
You can really see that they are escaping war and they bring the effects of war on their bodies. There are guys that have been tortured. There are guys with still the bullets on their bodies.
That's Carlota Sami of the UN Refugee Agency describing many refugees arriving in Greece after fleeing conflict areas. Details coming up. Also in the news, officials in Nigeria say more than 30 people have been killed in a bomb blast in Yola, the capital of Adamawa State. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Gabon and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, a new migrant and refugee crisis is brewing besides thousands of people crossing the Mediterranean from Libya to Italy. The UN Refugee Agency says it is stepping up operations in the Eastern Aegean islands of Greece. The UNHCR says in recent weeks, sea arrivals from Turkey have been averaging 600 people a day. It's straining Greece's limited resources to help them. In the first 5 months of this year, over 42,000 people have arrived by sea in Greece. That's six times more than a year ago. Most are from Syria, but others are from Afghanistan, Iraq, Somalia, and Eritrea. Carlota Sami is the UNHCR's regional spokesperson for Southern Europe. From the island of Kos, she spoke to VOA's Jody Capua about the influx of refugees.
We are monitoring the situation because from Turkey to Greece, it is increasing in a very considerable way. And the reality is that the arrivals of refugees in Greece are basically the same migrants and refugees arriving from Libya to Italy. The difference maybe here is that the largest coming from refugees-producing countries, in particular Syria, but as well Iraq, for example. Also, should be said that in comparison to Italy, Greece has enough resources and centers to cope with such a strong influx. And that's why today UNHCR decided to step up its field presence on the Greek islands with protection officers, with people that might help the local authorities to cope with the situation.
You say that Greece is hard-pressed to handle the number of refugees. What exactly is UNHCR doing to help Greek authorities deal with the influx?
We will work on several levels. We will work on helping authorities in identifying specific cases. I made an example today. I met with a woman that is traveling from Syria. She's pregnant and she's traveling alone with an autistic child. Such cases that need particular attention should be referred to proper authorities. So we will increase the presence of UNHCR field staff to help advising the authorities on how to deal with such cases. But we will also deliver non-food items. That means that we are already delivering blankets and we are delivering water because refugees do not have nothing to eat or to drink.
I'm reaching you on the Greek island of Kos. What is the condition of the refugees arriving there?
Well, the refugees arriving, they cross the sea on unseaworthy dinghies and they spent 3-4 hours at sea. They are quite okay, but some of them left Syria just a few days ago, and you can really see that they are escaping war and they bring the effects of war on their bodies. There are guys that have been tortured. There are guys with still the bullets on their bodies.
What other islands are affected by the refugee influx?
We are seeing that at least 15 islands in Greece are facing the same situation. So we are speaking of over 40,000 refugees arriving to Greece by sea from Turkey this year. Of course, if we compare these numbers with those that are present in Lebanon or in Turkey, where millions of refugees are there, These are small numbers, but we have to also to think that this is a European country and that this high influx in a way wasn't expected, or at least Greece is not strong enough at the moment to cope with that.
Has the UN Refugee Agency asked the European countries to help with Greece?
We asked today the European Union institution, the European Agency for Asylum, the European Agency for the Management of the European Borders to step up to support and help Greece in this moment.
Carlota Sami is the UNHCR's regional spokesperson for Southern Europe. From the Greek island of Kos, she spoke to VOA's Jody Kepawa. Members of Libya's Tripoli-based government known as New Dawn fear there is little chance of a peace deal being reached next week in talks with their Tobruk-based internationally recognized rival. They blame the UN's envoy for the failure to progress, saying he has been secretive and over-optimistic about the negotiations. Jamie Detmer reports from Tripoli.
UN envoy Bernardino Leon warned Wednesday that Libya is fast approaching a moment of truth, telling politicians gathered for 2 days of dialogue in Algiers that Libya needs a peace deal, as it is on the verge of ceasing to exist as a functioning state. But top members of the country's Tripoli-based government say a breakthrough is highly unlikely next week when talks are renewed in Morocco, and they blame the envoy.
فأنا أستغرب عن الدول التي تدعي بأنها يعني ديمقراطية وتحمي حقوق الإنسان وتحمي يعني.
To hear Mohamed Makni says what is highly perplexing to them is that there is this UN body that champions international law, but in this case it has decided to ignore a Libyan court ruling that decided the House of Representatives is illegitimate.
فهذا مفارقة عجيبة. وإذا تحدثنا على اليون شخص اليون لن يعني لن يستم يعني.
He accuses the UN envoy of failing to conduct the negotiations in a transparent manner. He says there's been a great deal of secrecy and Leon has not been even-handed and neutral. He also points out that the main negotiators for the two rival governments have not even met face to face. The UN envoy has been hard-pressed to get the government of the General National Congress, the parliament that refused to disband to give way for the House of Representatives, the legislature elected to replace it, to talk. Both sides have come under pressure from Western governments to find a way out of the impasse, arguing that while their forces clash in flare-ups across the country, Islamic extremists affiliated to the so-called Islamic State are gaining ground. Senior members of the Tripoli government say one of the UN drafts for a possible agreement contained details they had not agreed upon. They say a solution is quite simple. A national unity government that is formed by both sides. Abdul Gader Hawaili says that Western governments are prejudiced against the Tripoli government because they wrongly label it as Islamist.
This is propaganda. Mm-hmm. We are actually Muslim.
He does not believe the chances are good for a deal next week in Morocco.
Both the Libyans should meet together face to face and amend what Mr. Leon produced point by point. This is the best chance. Otherwise, we are going, if the peace negotiation with United Nations fail, we have program to meet still under the table to make Libyan-to-Libyan peace talk, okay, produced by Libya.
Some GNC members are more confident, including Abdi Mohamed Gade, an influential figure in Tripoli. He says the growth of the Islamic State group's affiliate in Libya is making a deal imperative and that he has faith negotiations will soon lead to a unity government. With the holy month of Ramadan starting in a matter of weeks, time is running out. Jamie Detmer for VOA News, Tripoli.
The Reuters news service says Burundi civil strife is affecting tax revenues. Official data shows about $22 million were collected in May, about 17% less than 1 year ago. Demonstrations have broken out regularly since late April, when President Pierre Nkurunziza announced he would run for another term. Critics say that would violate constitutional limits that set only 2 terms. However, a constitutional court ruled that the move is legal. Consumers are also complaining of rising food prices, and traders say there's a shortage of dollars even on the black market. A government official told the Reuters that the instability is affecting imports, trade, banks, and tax collection. And in other news from Burundi, authorities have withdrawn the accreditation of a reporter of France's 24 TV, Thais Brook. Officials say he violated the terms of his accreditation, which were only to cover elections. They said his presence had encouraged anti-government demonstrations, which he reported. The French press agency says several journalists covering the Burundi crisis have been threatened by police and security agents. Officials in Nigeria say more than 30 people have been killed in a bomb blast in Yola, the capital of Adamawa State, in Nigeria's northeast, where the militant group Boko Haram is active. Saad Bello of the National Emergency Management Agency said the blast happened late yesterday in the busy Jimeta market as buyers were doing last-minute shopping for the day. He said at least 31 people died and 38 others were being treated in area hospitals. No one has yet claimed responsibility for the blast, although Boko Haram extremists have carried out similar attacks. The French press agency says more than 80 people have died in Boko Haram attacks in Buhari's first week in office. Yesterday, human rights group Amnesty International said more than 8,000 Nigerians have died as a result of the government's campaign to stamp out the insurgent group. Amnesty said its researchers found more than 1,200 people have been executed since 2009 during raids by the Nigerian military. It says at least 7,000 more have died in custody because of torture, thirst, hunger, or severe overcrowding in jails. Amnesty is calling for Nigeria's new government to launch an investigation. Nigeria's former president, Goodluck Jonathan, made history by conceding defeat and handing power to his opponent in the March presidential election. Now that he's left office, analysts say Mr. Jonathan likely won't live much of a public life, at least in Nigeria. Chris Stein reports.
Hours after the inauguration ceremony for new Nigerian president Muhammadu Buhari, now former president Goodluck Jonathan was back in Yenagoa, capital of his home state Bayelsa, which he governed before ascending to the vice presidency and then the presidency itself. At 57 years old, Mr. Jonathan's future remains unclear. In a speech to supporters welcoming him home, he spoke of handing the reins to others who could build up Nigeria.
I remain most grateful for all Nigerians. The best I can do now is to dedicate the remaining part of my life to peace building across the country.
This year's election was essentially a rematch of the 2011 vote. Around 800 people died in the days after that election, as Mr. Buhari disputed his loss to Mr. Jonathan. In the run-up to the March polls, civil society groups had warned violence could happen again. But this time, Mr. Jonathan called Mr. Buhari and conceded defeat even before the final result was announced. Mr. Jonathan's grace after losing has prompted commentators to speculate that the international community would reward him somehow. Perhaps he would be a United Nations peace envoy, or be given a similar title by the African Union or West African Regional Bloc, ECOWAS. Emmanuel Onwubiko, a retired journalist and head of the Human Rights Writers Association of Nigeria, says Mr. Jonathan likely will not lead much of a public life in Nigeria. His future lies abroad, he says.
He should be very active in terms of, you know, the promotion of political virtues, such as peace building, conflict management, conflict resolution on the African continent and at the international levels.
Local media reported that Mr. Jonathan turned down a position on the board of trustees of his party, the People's Democratic Party, or PDP. Until Mr. Jonathan's loss, the party had held office in Nigeria since the country returned to democracy in 1999. As it transitions into being an opposition party for the first time in its history, former PDP party treasurer Bala Kaoje says the party will look to move beyond Mr. Jonathan.
I think if at all the PDP will want to revive itself, it has to more or less start, I think, afresh with the right kind of people who can give the correct leadership.
One thing is for sure, Onwu Biko says, Mr. Jonathan will be nothing like his sole living predecessor, former President Olusegun Obasanjo. Mr. Obasanjo was a thorn in Mr. Jonathan's side during his term. Weeks before the election, he publicly renounced his membership in the PDP, a move that some analysts say contributed to Mr. Jonathan's defeat. Chris Stein for VOA News, Dakar.
You are listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehis Wuhib in Washington. The Ebola virus, which ravaged West Africa and terrorized the world this past year, is largely under control, but if history is any guide, an outbreak is almost certain to happen again. Next time, though, healthcare workers will likely be better prepared to combat the deadly disease and protect themselves. In fact, researchers have discovered that some common drugs may shield from infection those who are exposed to the virus. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
Ebola is highly contagious, with a fatality rate of up to 90%. Doctors and nurses who tended to the sick and many patients' family members contracted the virus from contact with infected body fluids. As the virus spread unchecked, researchers raced to develop vaccines and treatments, most of which are still in the experimental phase. But now some well-known compounds, drugs long since approved for use against other disorders, may get new life for their ability to repel Ebola. A widely prescribed antidepressant, commonly known as Zoloft, and Vascor, a drug used to treat high blood pressure, were found to block the spread of the virus in a study of mice, and researchers say they potentially could protect people exposed to Ebola. Gene Olinger, a researcher with the U.S. National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Diseases in Frederick, Maryland, says the drugs contain a small molecule compound that works in two ways.
We're actually directly blocking the virus either by blocking a critical cell component, actually our cells have, that it needs to live, or it actually blocks the virus from getting in.
Vascor protected 100% of mice against infection with Ebola, and Zoloft was 70% effective, according to a study in the journal Science Translational Medicine. Olinger was part of a research team that screened 2,600 drugs already approved by regulatory authorities and found 30 agents, including antihistamines, that block the virus to some degree. Because the drugs are already known to be safe, Olinger says they could be rolled out quickly in an Ebola epidemic. The approval process for new drugs, he adds, could take years.
To do that requires at least 10 years, sometimes 15 years of clinical development, and requires about $1 billion. That's what the industry standard is. And so for these emerging pathogens, that's a long time to wait for an answer. So this is an opportunity to use what we have.
Zoloft and Vascor would likely be prescribed off-label in an Ebola emergency, meaning they would be used against the virus even though regulators had approved them for different diseases. That practice is common among doctors when they believe off-label use may relieve patient suffering. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
An Egyptian court has ordered a third and final trial for former President Hosni Mubarak on charges stemming from the killing of protesters during the 2011 uprising that forced his resignation. But while other Mubarak-era officials are one by one acquitted of crimes during his rule, ousted President Mohamed Morsi faces the death penalty, angering Islamists and other opposition figures, while militant attacks remain a constant reminder of the simmering anger in Egypt. VOA's Heather Murdoch reports from Cairo.
During the 2011 revolution in Egypt, protesters and police battled on the streets and crowds stormed the ruling party headquarters. They set the National Democratic Party building on fire, and the flames could be seen from Tahrir Square protests for days. For more than 4 years now, the charred building has stood empty, a symbol of struggle. A few days ago, the demolition began, but as symbols of the revolution fade, legal battles are in full swing. After being convicted of conspiring to kill more than 200 protesters in 2012 and having the same charges dropped in 2014, Mubarak will face his final trial, beginning in November. Prior to this announcement, former President Mubarak was expected to be freed any day, having already served his 3-year sentence on corruption charges. Human Rights Watch Director of Middle East and North Africa, Sarah Lee Whitson, says Mubarak's acquittal in 2014 is part of a larger problem.
It really follows the pattern that we've seen of acquittals of Mubarak-era officials who had been charged with a variety of crimes, the worst of which, of course, were the mass killings of protesters during the uprising against Mubarak, but also corruption charges.
Meanwhile, the Muslim Brotherhood's Mohamed Morsi, Mubarak's successor and fellow ousted president, is possibly facing the death penalty after he was convicted of conspiring to kill protesters. Thousands of other jailed Muslim Brotherhood supporters face harsh sentences, often after being tried in large groups. Ziad Akhl, a senior researcher at the Cairo-based Al-Ahram Center for Political and Strategic Studies, says the two cases are very different because of the current political climate.
You have to bear in mind that the quality of Mubarak's imprisonment is a very high quality, and he is in the most advanced medical facilities that we have in Egypt, which also kind of raises a question. I mean, someone from the Muslim Brotherhood just died a month ago because they wouldn't transfer him to the hospital, so he died in jail.
The crackdown on the Muslim Brotherhood, which has claimed hundreds of lives in recent years, has left the Egyptian judiciary with a clear anti-Islamist agenda, he says. And the government, led by President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, does not distinguish between the Muslim Brotherhood and other Islamist groups that have killed hundreds of security forces in the Sinai Peninsula in attacks since Morsi was thrown out of office by the military after mass protests in 2013. Akhl says uneven justice is part of a systemic problem that fosters extremism.
It's not only a security problem. The kind of terrorism that Egypt is facing right now, and it is a problem, I'm not trying to undermine it, but I'm just saying that it's as much a problem of security measures as it's a problem of political considerations, as it's a problem of legislative consideration, as it's a problem of cultural and social consideration.
On Wednesday, two police officers were killed near the pyramids in what appeared to be an attack on the tourism industry, a significant part of Egypt's income. Egyptian publisher and editor Hisham Qasim says the presidential trials are unrelated to the violence and are part of a process of building a less corrupt and freer country.
Putting heads of state on trial is now, with Morsi and Mubarak, giving two messages to people like el-Sisi and the future presidents. One, if you're the president of the country, do not be corrupt. The second one is, when the people hit the street, step down. That was Morsi's mistake.
In Tahrir Square Thursday, 21-year-old Shams al-Din, a tour guide, stands in view of the crumbling ruling party building as it is knocked down. Al-Din does not think about presidential trials or politics these days. He said he is glad the old building is being destroyed, but not because it is a symbol of the old regime. The building, he says, is just old, and Egypt deserves something new. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Cairo.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Yiswuhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America. This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. A new migrant and refugee crisis is brewing in the eastern Aegean islands of Greece as thousands arrive from Syria, Afghanistan, Iraq, Somalia, and Eritrea. And officials in Nigeria say more than 30 people have been killed in a bomb blast in Yola, the capital of Adamawa State, in Nigeria's northeast, where the militant group Boko Haram is active. Coming up, music from Gabon, and in our feature segment, a group of young Egyptian medical doctors performing free surgery for hundreds of patients in South Sudan. I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Hello, Sunny.
Happy Friday, Yehiz.
Sunny, I understand it's a big weekend in football.
Yehiz, Saturday is a big day in international football. The 2014 Women's World Cup kicks off in Edmonton, Canada, and Barcelona will play Juventus for the biggest prize in European club football, the UEFA Champions League trophy in Berlin, Germany. Ladies first. The month-long Women's World Cup begins with a Group A match between host Canada and China. And that will be followed on Saturday by a game between New Zealand and the Netherlands, also in Edmonton. The 2015 Women's World Cup is the first to be played on artificial turf. And that's a controversial issue, since players say it makes them more susceptible to injuries. In fact, 84 players from 13 different national teams called artificial turf substandard and dangerous in a planned lawsuit, but they dropped the legal action ahead of the tournament. American star Abby Wambach, one of the players involved, says while the legal action ended, it marks the start of even greater activism to ensure fair treatment when it comes to women's sports. The players said FIFA and the Canadian Soccer Association would never dream of asking top men's footballers to play a World Cup on artificial turf. The Sunny Side of Sports supports Abby Wambach and is hoping this seventh edition of the Women's World Cup will be the last to be played on artificial turf. Give them regular grass like the boys. Previous editions of the women's tournament featured 16 teams, and with the field expanded to 24, it's given new opportunities for countries to make their marks in women's football. Of the three African teams in Canada, two of them, Cameroon and Ivory Coast, are playing in their inaugural Women's World Cup. Both African sides figure to have a tough road in getting out of the group stage. Cameroon will have to contend with Ecuador, Switzerland, and reigning world champion Japan. Ivory Coast, meanwhile, is grouped with Thailand, 1995 world champion Norway, and two-time world champion Germany. The Super Falcons of Nigeria have been the most successful team in African women's football over the years. But the Nigerian women also have their work cut out for them in Canada. Their group with Australia, Sweden, and the two-time world champion United States. Let's take a quick look at the opening matches for the three African teams. Ivory Coast will play Germany in its first match on Sunday. Cameroon and Nigeria will begin their campaigns the next day on Monday. Cameroon will meet Ecuador, while Nigeria will play Sweden. Now let's go to New Zealand for an update on the FIFA Under-20 World Cup for men. The Black Satellites of Ghana defeated Panama Friday 1-0 in Auckland to finish atop the Group B table with 7 points from three matches. Emmanuel Boateng scored the goal for Ghana in the 82nd minute. Ghana will travel to Wellington, New Zealand for its next match on June 10th in the round of 16. The opponent is still to be determined. In Friday's other Group B match, Austria and Argentina battled to a scoreless draw in Wellington. The Austrians are through to the knockout stage with 5 points from three matches, while Argentina is packing its bags with 2 points from the tournament. In Group A results Friday, host New Zealand trounced Myanmar, formerly known as Burma, 5-1, and Ukraine beat the United States 3-0. The Ukrainians and the Americans are through to the round of 16 knockout stage with 7 and 6 points, respectively. In Berlin on Saturday, Barcelona of Spain and Juventus of Italy will meet in the UEFA Champions League final. Juventus defender Giorgio Chiellini has been ruled out of Saturday's big match with a calf injury suffered in training on Wednesday. Barcelona appears to have no injury concerns before the big game. Juventus is bidding for its third European title, while star-studded Barca, featuring Lionel Messi, Neymar, and Luis Suarez in the attack, is aiming for its fifth European crown. New research says African American athletes are more likely to be portrayed negatively in the media than white athletes. The findings appear in a new book entitled How You See Me, How You Don't. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Cynthia Frisbee is an associate professor at the University of Missouri's School of Journalism. As part of her strategic communication course, she challenges her students to face any biases they may have when reporting a story. Her interaction with her students eventually led her to research media coverage of male athletes and whether black and white athletes receive different treatment. Frisbee chose 155 online news articles from Sports Illustrated, The Bleacher Report, CNN, CBS Sports, Sporting News, Yahoo Sports, AOL, Sports Service, and ESPN.
Of the total stories, 68 or 43.9% were on white athletes, and 38.7% were on black.
She identified a number of themes, including crime, domestic violence, moral success or failure, cheating, lifestyle, and individual accomplishments. She begins with her findings on crime-related stories.
66.7% of the stories were on crime that dealt with black athletes, compared to 22.2% for white. When it came to domestic and sexual violence stories, 70.6% focused on the black athlete, whereas 17.6% were on white. When it came to training, work ethic, their dedication, 42.9% were focused on white athletes, where 35.7% were on black.
Frisbee gives more of her findings.
The morally successful stories, 83.3% were on white athletes, where there was only one story, which amounted to 8.3% on black athletes. Accomplishments, 20 of the stories, 58.8% were white, whereas 8 stories, or 23.6%, were black. On their personal lifestyle, 42.9% were white versus 33.3% black. And then athletics or skills or abilities, 46.2% were about white athletes, and then 23.1% or 3 stories were on black.
One thing her research did not reveal was the race of the reporters behind the stories.
You know, honestly, that's something that I want to do in the future. It was very, very hard to determine by their bylines. And then we tried to do that, but it was just taking an immense amount of time because, you know, we'd have to go to the newspaper site and then look up their staff.
Frisbee says she wants her students to consider whether media portrayals of African Americans are reflected in how they report.
When it comes to blacks, there are 3 typical portrayals that we find in the media: criminal, entertainer, or athletic.
She says a 2013 study shows many Americans believe black athletes are criminals. She questions whether that perception stems from modern TV, films, and other media.
A lot of times people would say, when I was talking about my research, well, isn't it true that athletes are more aggressive? And I went to the crime rate and statistics numbers and was, again, a little surprised to find that athletes in general, regardless, commit fewer crimes than the regular male in their same age group.
She also says media portrayals of African Americans may even affect how her students react to her.
So, for example, I'm an African American professor, and I will have students that sometimes the only experience or contact that they've had with someone like me is through the media. And you would be surprised at how much media consumption plays a role in our attitudes and our formation of particular kinds of stereotypes.
One such portrayal of African Americans, she says, is found in rap music.
We know white suburban boys love rap music. What if you see these images and then you get to me, which I violate all of that? How do you respond to that disparity and discrepancy of what you've come to know through the media, and now you've met somebody that doesn't fit? Do you discount her?
The University of Missouri journalism professor says her research is just a first step. While she hopes it raises awareness for today's reporters, it also raises many questions about how stereotypes are formed and affect behavior. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
In Game 1 of the National Basketball Association Finals, the Golden State Warriors defeated the visiting Cleveland Cavaliers 108-100 in overtime. After an 8-day break, the NBA's top teams and biggest stars put on quite a show in the western U.S. city of Oakland, California. Golden State star Stephen Curry, the league's most valuable player, had 26 points and 8 assists, while Cavaliers star LeBron James fired in 44 points, a career high for him in the NBA Finals. LeBron missed 20 shots from the field, though, including a long jumper at the end of regulation. The Warriors took control in the overtime period, while the Cavaliers missed their first 8 shots in the extra session. Golden State is in the NBA Finals for the first time in 40 years. Cleveland, meanwhile, is hoping for its first major professional sports championship in 51 years. Yes, the Ohio City has waited a long, long time. Speaking after the loss, Cavaliers coach David Blatt says his team will need to do more around LeBron in Game 2, which will be played Sunday night in Oakland, California. Remember, VOA basketball fans, the NBA Finals are best of 7, so the first team to win 4 games will be crowned the champion. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Have a good weekend, everyone. Back to Yahias Wuhee.
Thank you, Sonny, and listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Friday, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America. Coming up, a group of young Egyptian medical doctors performing free surgery for hundreds of patients in South Sudan. And next, a company in Ghana becoming the leading producer of bamboo bicycles in West Africa. But first, some music. Here is Oliver Ngoma with Ngebe. Gabon's Oliver Ngoma with Ngebe. A group of young Egyptian medical doctors performed free surgery for hundreds of patients at Wau Teaching Hospital in South Sudan's West Bahr El Ghazal province. The team of 15 doctors from the Alexandria State Ministry of Health was expected to treat 700 patients in Wau in 1 week. Dimo Silva reports from Wau.
State authorities say they are sharing the visiting doctors' expenses with the Egyptian government. The state of Western Bahr El Ghazal is paying for the doctors' accommodation, meals, and their return travel to Egypt. The Egyptian government is paying for the other leg of their transportation and for the equipment they need to carry out medical procedures. Isaac Kleto is Western Bahr El Ghazal's state minister of health. He says the arrival of the Egyptian doctors is a blessing for many. Kleto says his state has few doctors with the same skills as the Egyptian medical team. He says the state also lacks the medical equipment doctors need to perform complex procedures. Kleto thinks bringing the doctors to South Sudan is a good investment.
But we thought that as a government, we put the resources that we have to make this camp. In the past, we used to make camps like this, for example, in one specialty, like eye problem. But this time, we tried to do a more comprehensive one. That's why we have this big number of 15 doctors who are specialized in various areas.
Kleto said the week-long visit by the Egyptian doctors will help strengthen the state's health system because local doctors will be able to interact with their Egyptian counterparts and gain experience. Kleto hopes some chronically ill residents of the state will be able to receive treatment that will improve their quality of life. He says hundreds of people have signed up to see their visiting doctors.
We agreed that for the ophthalmology, daily we see 100. Up to now, those with eye problems who have registered are 300. So this way, we see them in 3 days, they finish even before that week. And then for the medicine, that is the physician, we see 50 on daily basis. Up to now, those who are registered, I think around 200. So if you say, for example, if you see 50 on daily basis because they don't have operations, it's easy for them to see a big number. And again, the operations of eye problems are quicker and they don't stay long in the hospital. That's why we see big numbers. See them, diagnose them, take them to the theater, operate on them, and then the next day, you discharge them. And again, in Ops and Gyna, we open also fixed number.
The number of people registering for the free medical services is increasing as people from the neighboring states of Warab, Northern Bahr El Ghazal, and Lakes show up at Wau Teaching Hospital after hearing of the visiting medical team. Professor Mohamed Higezi works with Cairo University as an orthopedic surgeon. He says the turnout has surpassed the Egyptian doctor's capacity. Higezi warns that the visitors might not be able to treat everyone in the limited time that they are in South Sudan.
We have equipment with us, but this equipment could not treat every patient. We need another set of instruments to treat all patients. But the instruments we have lots of patients to do. And we are operating in the maternity theaters, and we managed to operate 4 operating tables. And we are working since yesterday doing cataract operations and eye extraction of cataract in old patients, blind patients, to make them see. And today we continue, and for the next 4 days. It will do for some patients. Some patients will benefit from this, but you could not treat all Wau patients in 7 days.
Matthew Chan, who has suffered from eye problems since 2010, is among those seeking treatment for the Egyptian doctors. He wants the Egyptian doctors to stay for longer than 7 days.
Let them come and make a month or 2 months so that they can save people. 7 days, that's nothing. See now, how many people? A lot. Thousands of thousands of people who are blind and they need treatment. Not only 7 days. If they want by any money that you pay, peace is to be paid. See now, people are now beating themselves because it is free of charge. Let a little bit call to the people so that they get something.
Between them, the Egyptian doctors cover different medical specialties, including orthopedics, eye diseases, general medicine, cancer, and vein surgery. Over the next week, they will also be performing kidney operations, dental procedures, obstetric and gynecological exams, and pediatric and neonatal surgeries. Hospital authorities say that as of today, the Egyptian doctors have successfully completed around 300 procedures, mostly involving eye diseases and injuries. For VOA, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Wau.
A bicycle production company in Kumasi, Ghana, called Boomers International, is rapidly becoming the leading producer of bamboo bicycles in West Africa. VOA's Polindiho recently visited the company and has more.
People are likely to ask, what kind of bike is that? And the answer is, it's a bamboo bike. An improved version that was first unveiled in 2009. For those who dare to be bold, this bamboo bike has a striking design, one that commands attention. Voice of America was recently given behind-the-scenes exclusive access, so let's take it for a road test. Boomers International is a subsidiary social enterprise of the Yansu Project. The company is located in the Ashanti region of Ghana, and it specializes in producing bamboo-framed bicycles which are exported to countries around the world. Kwebena Danso is the CEO of Boomers International.
Our whole focus is to train rural youth with the skills of building bamboo bicycles to give them employment and also be able to market these to support to market this on both on the international and the local market.
Bicycles made from bamboo have been around for more than a century, but the demand has only increased in recent years. Today, Boomers International is seizing the opportunity to make use of this abundant natural resource, and the company is investing in the sustainability and the development of the local communities.
For every bike that is sold, a child in the rural area also gets education. So we're trying to promote education, support rural community development through education, empower these children in the rural communities by the sales of our bikes.
John Mafo is the head of the technical team at Boomers International.
I feel very happy because without this company, I never thought I'd be at even that place, or people would be much very interested in me in that way. So I'm very happy.
Some other apprentices have had the pleasure of being trained by Danso, who has given them the skills they need to build eco-friendly bicycles.
Okay, I take the inventory here. The tools they will be needing at the workshop. Maybe they will be needing hardener to spray the bikes. I give it to them and I record it.
Kwebena Danso says bamboo is the ideal crop to work with. It can be sustainably harvested and grows fast, without needing pesticides. The process requires the bamboo to be dry for 6 months and reinforced with carbon fiber. All the bicycles are handmade, which is reflected in the price tag.
This is a complete assembled bike made in Ghana here. This is the fork, the steer, and then we've also provided light in case you are riding in the evening or at night.
Boomers International is already planning to expand the brand to sell on the local market. Bike analysts say Ghana's fast-growing population and rapid urban development means there are more cars on the road. But having locally manufactured bikes could ease the crush of people using public transportation. Reporting for VOA News, Paul Ndiho in Kumasi, Ghana.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Jackson Infunganye, and our engineer, Audrey Esrigas, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United Nations Security Council has unanimously adopted a resolution calling on member states and all parties to armed conflict to protect journalists in conflict zones and elsewhere. The resolution declared that the work of a free and independent media is essential to a democratic society and called on states to ensure there is accountability for crimes against media personnel in armed conflict and to respect the right of journalists everywhere to exercise their profession without intimidation. Resolution 2222 was adopted as the violence against journalists worldwide continues to rise, including summary executions, kidnappings, and imprisonment. Speaking to the Security Council, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Samantha Power highlighted the case of Mazen Darwish, head of the Syrian Center for Media and Freedom of Expression, which reported on the atrocities committed by the Assad regime. Mr. Darwish and his two colleagues, Hani Zitani and Hussein Garir, were arrested and imprisoned by regime authorities in 2012. Their trial has been suspended 24 times. Ambassador Power noted that it is not only in conflict zones that journalists are in danger.
Look to any region and you will see alarming warning signs of how the crackdown on press freedom is coupled with a broader crackdown on civil and political rights.
Her examples included the imprisonment in Ethiopia of 9 journalists, including 6 bloggers from the Collective Zone 9, who have been behind bars since April 2014, charged under Ethiopia's anti-terrorism proclamation. Ambassador Power noted that for every journalist or group targeted through prosecution, attacks, and threats, countless more are impacted, self-censoring, hiding, or fleeing countries that desperately need their independent voices. With Resolution 2222, the international community has underlined the need to protect journalists and the right to free expression, insisting that states and other groups who violate this right be held accountable. It is now the responsibility of all to move from affirmation to implementation of this crucial principle.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.